This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice. We're going to talk about listening a bit later. It's a much underrated art and it has real benefits. Let's start with speed. Could the speed, the tempo, at which staff walk and talk affect the outcome of the workplace? Too fast and work might be rushed. Too slow and performance might be poor. The man you're about to meet says that tempo or pace reflects something important about what a workplace does and its culture. Professor Geoffrey Braithwaite is the founding director of the Australian Institute of Health Innovation at Macquarie University. He says the ideal setup is the Goldilocks zone.
The Goldilocks zone is the sweet spot in organisations. It's the place where it's not too fast, so it's overheating, and not too slow, so it's inefficient.
Right. So we'll unpack what that means. Is that about how quickly things are done? How quickly people move? What is it?
It's fundamentally about the culture underpinning everything behavioural and cognitive in organisations. In the collective mind of people and the collective behaviours is the culture. And the culture is expressed in organisations in various ways.
Right.
And one way that's not very well researched is what about the pace of organisational life?
And it's always going to be context specific, isn't it? So if you're in perhaps a police operations centre, sometimes things need to happen really quickly. If you're studying medieval literature and hoping to develop something that somebody's just discovered, that can happen more slowly.
Beautiful examples, but my area is healthcare, and I'm very interested in hospitals, and they're a great laboratory for this kind of research. So if you go to the emergency department, sometimes it's red hot fast. There's a busload of injured people just come to the door. Other times they're waiting for the next patient to arrive in a down spot. And you can imagine in different parts of a hospital, palliative care, where people are essentially trying to die with dignity, It's a gentle, slow pace. In a busy ward, where there's lots of surgical patients having procedures coming and going, it's a different pace. But overarchingly in an organisation, just like there's an overarching organisational culture, or I think you like the word tone, So there is different organisational personalities embedded in the culture between different hospitals or different police call centres.
So there's going to be different Goldilocks zones within a hospital.
Yep.
Depending on what's being done there. But overall, you can kind of, to mix our metaphors, you can kind of take the temperature of a place. There'll be one across a whole hospital too, in a way.
There will be, and there is. And you know that when you walk into an organisation, even if you haven't studied and written papers and books on culture like I have, you get a sense of the place. And that's the unique organisational culture. Definitely there'll be hotspots and not such hotspots in terms of pace and tempo, depending on parts of the organisation, but there will be an overarching. Dare I say to you and your listeners, there's a culture in the ABC That's an overarching culture. But different departments may have different reflections of that.
Yeah, yes. Look, I started my career in the newsroom. It's a much busier pace than working at Radio National is, for example, or busier or different again to perhaps making a documentary series on television. So, yes, you're quite right. So if we look at some of the studies from the past, this idea of looking at pace, that's been linked to a faster lifestyle, which was at first, or some time ago, linked to increased risk from things like coronary heart disease, and yet, paradoxically, better subjective well-being.
So there's paradoxes here. This isn't simplistic conceptualizations or research. So in the old studies in the 70s, people did a study of cities, And different cities had a different pace of life, and you don't even have to go to those cities to sort of think that. Some were fast-paced, and that was linked to higher GDP for that city. Some were slower paced, and that was lower GDP. But counterintuitively, perhaps, it's also linked to some bad things if you have a fast pace. And that's what got us interested in the idea, because at too fast a pace, you might get great GDP, but you get stress and burnout and high smoking rates, etc. But as you say, it's also interesting that people report higher subjective well-being. Now, maybe that's related more to the GDP increases that they get from being in a fast-paced city.
And I suppose you could take that idea and transplant it to the workplace, because if you've got a fast pace all the time, you are more likely to have burnout, aren't you, in your people?
Indeed. And so fast pace, too fast, too long, and you get stress. You don't just get arousal to be up for the job and motivation. You go beyond that, people get stretched. People get stretched and, you know, the place overheats. And that's not good.
What happens if it's too slow?
Too slow? Well, that's the other end of the continuum, if you want to see it on a continuum.
Yeah, well, it is.
And then you get inefficiency, but also people aren't up for the job anymore, are they? And you could actually get errors because too long at a job and too much slackness built in. You need some slackness built in. You need some scope for people to think, not just to do in workplaces. But too little, and you could get the opposite end of the spectrum. The porridge is just too cold.
There needs to be some tension or pressure about performance, doesn't there?
There does. We could talk about individuals. We're talking about collectivities here.
Yeah, yeah.
Some individuals are up for it no matter what happens.
Yes, that's true.
They've got a buzz, they're motivated, and you know, you could almost compress them and they'd still bounce back.
That's,
you know,
it.
Bobo doll sort of person.
Pop them into the power supply and they'd light up Geelong for you.
Love your metaphors. Yes, exactly. But for most people, if we're talking about culture as a collective, we're saying the Goldilocks hypothesis, which is what we've labelled this, is it's just right. And that's the perfect space. It's, dare I say it, wouldn't that be where best practice is found?
Yes, well, it would be. Okay, so what can we say about what the Goldilocks zone is and how much it affects your area of interest, which is how well hospitals do at looking after people?
Okay, so I'm a scientist. We need measures. So what are the measures for the Goldilocks effect, the Goldilocks hypothesis, where it's in the sweet spot, it's just right. People aren't too fast and running around, running into each other almost, creating errors and harm maybe to patients because they're not doing things thoroughly anymore. Or that, you know, pace just isn't, nobody switched on and it's all too lethargic. So the sweet spot is there. Now you need measures. So the measures we're looking at, this is work in progress, research in train. How rapidly or not rapidly do people walk across a long corridor, the main spine of the hospital? How long does it take to get a prescription filled at the pharmacy? How long does it take people to answer the phone at the switchboard, or if the switchboard puts you through to Ward 1A in each of a number of hospitals? And you do that measure repeatedly, get an average, and then you can say something about the pace in that hospital. And then having a measure for pace, a cultural, the cultural aspect of tempo in the organization, you can then relate that to who produces the most harm and errors.
Right. So you're looking for the fewest errors and the best outcomes for patients.
Indeed. Well, the best outcomes for patients and the organization. Maybe that's where better teamwork happens. Maybe that's where better care occurs.
And you can actually get these different data sets, because that's what you're dealing with, to talk to one another.
Yes. We relate one to another and say, what is the association between the sweet spot of pace and errors and harm in the organization?
So what I'm thinking is there isn't a magic number, or not a magic number that's a magic number for everybody, but perhaps each organization has a magic number which they may or may not have achieved.
True. You could create, I mean, this might be too technical, but you could create an index.
Yeah.
And a composite of all the numbers that you gather, all the research findings that you gather, and produce a number for the ideal organization, but also the ideal for that particular organization.
Can you reverse engineer this? So can you say to people, look, this is our number. We need it to be this. Can everyone just answer the phone a bit quicker and cross this corridor a bit quicker? Would that have an effect? Because you can imagine that if you have to think about it, if you're encouraged to think about it and you don't just reject it out of hand as some ridiculous new missive from up high in the organisation, and you think, okay, well, let's give it a go, actually moving that kinetic effect does inform other things. It's all connected, and perhaps you start to be more efficient as well.
Yeah. So can you encourage the right sort of briskness, tempo and pace in the workforce and therefore get better care, in my case, in hospitals, or better services and output? I don't know. That's a step beyond the research where we're at the moment.
Mm.
Maybe you're describing the next research proposal.
All right. So what can you say based on what you know at the moment?
I think people could look at their own organisation, and no doubt they're listening. If they're listening to this, they're doing that now, thinking about their own organisation and saying, are we too slow? Is there too much? It's too little tempo. We might be trying to do things thoroughly, but there's no efficiency measure here. There's no efficiency going on. Or is it just where everybody's frantic? Now, I know in modern life, everyone says, you know, it's fragmented and busy and relentless and difficult and, you know, et cetera. But is it just too much overcooked in the organization where we do risk quality? We do risk good products and good customer service.
This is very salient here, of course, because like other media organizations, the ABC has lost people and we're all doing more with less than we used to. And I think one of the things that my colleagues would say and have said is that the thinking time has gone down.
I'm a professor and I say that, and most people in the public would say that's what I should be doing, a bit of thinking time, because my job's pretty busy too. So I think all of us, that's a nice heedful remark for all of us. Can we build in, if it's too overheated, if it's too fast, if it's too rapid-paced, can we build in a bit of thinking time? That's not a bad thing for most of us, I suspect, in the modern era.
What I'm intrigued by, what I find so interesting about your research, is it makes explicit what has been tacit. You walk into a place and you quickly pick this stuff up, and you're almost doing it subconsciously, but you realise what the tone and the pace and the rhythms of the place are. And the more time you spend there, the better handle on it you get. But you're actually generating numbers, and with numbers, it makes things explicit.
True. I think there's lots of concepts around the whole idea of best practice. Isn't best practice itself is a concept, okay?
Mm.
I do research. I run a large research institute, and our job is to try and provide the evidence base that underpins some of these complex social constructs.
Well, I think it's really interesting. It's been really interesting getting you in. Thank you very much for joining me today, Geoffrey.
Thank you indeed, Richard.
Professor Geoffrey Braithwaite's in charge of the Australian Institute of Health Innovation at Macquarie University. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adey. If you have to manage people, how much do you find yourself listening? So asking questions and really listening to what they have to say. It's an undervalued skill, according to my next guest. Corin Armour is a leadership trainer, author and coach. And she says that too often, leaders aren't so good at listening. Instead, they get caught up in the telling. Sort of, I'm the boss, so I have to decide and let people know.
That's exactly it. And when we tell people what to do, they might be listening and their rational brain might even be engaged. But that's not going to lead to any sort of empowerment or accountability or real engagement. Whereas when we ask questions, like good questions that lead people towards insight, and insight's that flash where we bring together seemingly unrelated ideas and form a new idea. In that moment of insight, that's when people really step up, when they come to their own conclusions. And it's rewarding to the brain. So we're triggering the reward response in the brain. There's a release of dopamine, a neurochemical that's associated with that happy feeling that we have. There's involvement in the brain from the hippocampus, which is responsible for long-term memory. So we're much more likely to remember something that we came up with ourselves than something that our boss told us to do. And then there's an emotional engagement because the amygdala is involved, which is part of the brain responsible for emotional arousal. And we're bringing together different ideas. We're making rich neuronal connections to things we already know. So in the future, we can take that insight that we've had and we can extrapolate it to other situations. So we're not just dealing with this one thing that I can tell you what to do right now. When I'm asking you questions that lead to insight, then a whole lot more happens.
The key is asking the questions. Is that more important than listening to the answers?
No, absolutely not. No, listening is absolutely critical. To be a leader who asks, one of the key competencies is listening. And listen in a way that's supportive and that brings about a connection, not just an understanding. I think that's fairly superficial level of listening is to listen to understand. But when we really listen to connect, then we're forming much deeper relationships that leave people feeling more valued and more empowered.
But you were talking about all the things that happen in the brain, and we have an increasingly good understanding of this when the right questions are asked. And I thought, oh, maybe the real value is in that, what you prompt when you ask the right question.
It is, but that places a huge amount of pressure on them. And so I tend to encourage leaders just to ask more questions. Ask more open questions that you don't know the answers to. In fact, I had a really interesting conversation with a leader last week. So he'd 18 months ago been promoted to the first executive role, but he'd just received a battery of profiles and performance feedback and 360 review feedback. And what he was horrified about was that one of the particular profiles measured his tendency to be directive as a leader and his tendency, among other styles, to coach. And the coaching one was way down in a red zone. It was sort of low at the bottom of the page. And the directive style was by far his strongest preference and overused. And he was horrified about that because he said to me, some of the free form feedback I've got is that I'm really inquisitive and analytical and I ask a lot of questions. So how can I be asking a lot of questions and yet not seen to be coaching? And I said to him, so tell me about a situation where you've asked some of those questions. And when we explored it, what he realized that is that he was asking questions to display his own knowledge. And he was asking questions that are leading. So why do we do it this way? What if? And he wasn't asking questions that were taking him out of his comfort zone or the other person. So I call them questions in sheep's clothing. Yes, they're questions because grammatically they have a question mark at the end, but we all know they're not a real question. And there's a power balance there that you were implying as well, that we need to be very aware that as leaders we're heard differently. And so if we're thinking out loud, we need to say we're thinking out loud. But if we're asking a good question, then we need to allow the other person time to think about it. And we need to have created an environment of trust and openness and courage and curiosity so that they don't feel like they're being on the spot, so that they don't feel like there's a wrong answer or a right answer.
I'm really interested in that word curiosity, because I think that's really important. If you can ask a question and say, look, I don't know the answer to this, that's very much more empowering than asking a question where it's implied that there is a right answer.
That's absolutely it. I think curiosity is critical, and curiosity is an antidote to judgment. So quite often leaders slip into judgment. In their listening, there is an implied judgment. I always say when you notice that, flick yourself back into curiosity. And perhaps the curiosity starts with, why am I being judgmental? And do I feel like I'm being on display here? Actually, I worked with a client a couple of years ago and he was highly judgmental. But if I had have said that to him when I first met him, that would have meant that our relationship was fairly short-lived and we wouldn't have had the opportunity to move past that. So it took me a while to build his trust. And I said to him one day, do you think you're judgmental? And he said, me? Absolutely not. I said, okay, good. So I said, can we play a little game? He said, I want you to just notice just during the day when you're making judgments. And if you do, I want you to just text me and say, I just noticed this judgment and I was able to let it go. And he didn't think that this was going to be a particularly useful activity, but by that stage we had sufficient trust and he tried it out. And so the next morning, about 7:30 in the morning, I'd already received a text and he was judging the truck driver and the road in front of him and he realised that and he'd let it go. And then the next day I had a text before 9 o'clock, he was judging the homeless guy out the front of the office and then he was judging people he worked with. And he realized that he was running judgments on everybody. And mostly he was running judgments on himself, which made it almost impossible for him to live up to his own expectations. And so when we were able to reframe that in terms of curiosity, that allowed a softening that shifted all of his relationships.
One of the things that we haven't talked about, but it seems to me the thread running through a lot of this, is humility. So great leaders will talk about the importance of humility. But in fact, it's very hard for leaders to be humble and to display it to the people who work for them, isn't it?
I think about that as a combination of compassion and courage. So you have to have courage to be willing to go into a conversation that you don't have the answer to. When you ask good open-ended questions, you lose control in the nicest possible way of the conversation. And that takes courage. And it takes courage to ask questions that might lead people in an emotional direction, because you know, other people's stuff can be messy and our own stuff can be even messier. So that takes a degree of courage. And then there's the compassion that overlays that. Compassion for me, for myself, and compassion for the people that I'm working with. And I think when you get those two things, then humility results from that.
It also connects to something that you write about in the book about the fearless leader who gives up the need to be in control.
Yeah, yeah. We spend so much of our time, particularly as more junior leaders, needing to be in control. You know, I've been promoted. Now I need to demonstrate that I know what's going on. And it takes a real level of leadership maturity to realize that actually we don't have all the answers. And the pace of change of the environment that we're working in, the increasing complexity, the competition that's coming from non-traditional places, the disruption that's happening within industry, no one person has the answer to any of that. So when I work with leadership teams, the focus is really on how do we leverage the diversity right across the leadership team, because that's the only way we can solve these complex challenges. It's by being collectively curious.
Now, you talk about several different sorts of leaders, and we've just briefly touched on the fearless leader, but there's also the indifferent leader, the distracted leader, the present leader, and the committed leader. Now, two of them sound not so good. Three of them sound better. Just run through them.
So what we're really talking about there is the leader's focus on their ability to ask questions and to sit in this discomfort, to have the courage that we're talking about. And so at the bottom, we have an indifferent leader who, while they might be technically very strong, they really don't understand the power of using questions and a coaching technique to connect with their people. Then as we move up that ladder and we have leaders who are better understanding the power of questions and understanding the ability to connect to and to leverage the expertise that's in the team, that's when we have people who are more comfortable and confident to be asking those questions and to be committed to this way of working and ultimately to build a fearless culture.
There is this bias that we have in which we privilege certainty, conviction, you know, and we don't have to look too far, especially in the political realm, to see how, I suppose, potent that can be.
Yeah.
But we know increasingly complicated problems mostly don't require simple solutions, that simple approaches don't work to solving those complicated problems.
Absolutely. And of one of the competencies of the leader who asks is that ability to be in the uncertainty and to keep other people feeling a level of security and safety within that uncertainty. It's not only, as you say, that we value certainty, but that we're also so short-term focused. And nothing great is created by valuing certainty to that level and a constant focus on the short term. We need to take ourselves into the unknown, despite the fact that evokes a threat response in the brain, and think about things over the longer term. And that's a challenge.
Corinne, it's been really interesting having you on the show. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Richard.
Corinne Armour is a leadership trainer and coach. Her new book is Leaders Who Ask, Building Fearless Cultures by Telling Less and Asking More. And you'll find details on our homepage at abc.net.au/Radio National. And that's it for today. Best Practice is produced by Mudita Dias and Anne Arnold. Our sound engineer is Hamish Camilleri. I'm Richard Adie.